Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the political wrangling over the so-called fiscal cliff and get some clarity on the real economic situation, not the fatuous theatrics the press is fixated on. Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, joins us to discuss how the people who caused our economic troubles are trying to exploit a phony crisis to enrich themselves further. Then we'll look into the Roger Ailes, the power behind the throne of right-wing politics in America, whose emissary was caught on tape offering the recently disgraced General Petraeus the presidency. Dr. Kerwin Swint, the author of Dark Genius, the influential career of legendary political operative and Fox News founder Roger Ailes, joins us to discuss the latest effort to corrupt our democracy by the mendacious Murdoch Empire. Then finally, we will speak with the former head of the Political Science Department at American University Cairo, Sheila Karapiko, about Egypt's embattled new leader and his power grab that has resulted in paralysis and polarization. We'll examine the likely outcome of next week's referendum on a new constitution that the opposition is boycotting, making it likely to pass since the fundamentalist bloc of Muslim Brotherhood voters are sure to show up in lockstep. And joining us now is Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. His latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
And the clock, of course, is ticking on this so-called fiscal cliff, which I think is an entirely phony, apocalyptic construction on the part of Republicans and the press who go along with it. But nevertheless, Congress is due to adjourn on December the 21st. So the last day to introduce a bill is December 18, and the president is leaving for Hawaii the day before on December 17. So what's your guess, Dean Baker, on whether anything's going to get done before then?
Well, I'd say it's probably a little better than 50-50 that something will get done. But I think the reason for that isn't that we have this disaster awaiting us December 31st or January 1st, as many have implied. It's that the Republicans understand at the end of the day they really have no bargaining power in this story, because the most immediate issue is what happens to the lower tax rates, the Bush tax cuts for the top 2%. And President Obama ran on this. You know, he said he would restore those tax rates to the Clinton era level. He won the election, and come this January 1st, if nothing's done, those tax rates go up. Now, after that, President Obama said he wants to keep the Bush tax cuts in place for the bottom 98%, which is something the Republicans want to do as well. That will eventually be a hit to the economy. Whether they do it by January 1st or not really matters almost not at all. So what's likely to happen if the Republicans don't agree to President Obama's terms before the end of the year is that they're going to come back in January and they'll agree to his terms and realize they looked extremely foolish for dragging it out. So we don't face a disaster. The Republicans face perhaps a political humiliation, having to turn around and tuck their tail between their legs. But the idea we face a disaster, it's just complete nonsense.
So the president and the Democrats deal, which is actually an exit for the Republicans, which is to just pass the tax cut, keeping the tax cuts for those under $250,000. And letting the tax cuts expire on those the top 2%. That's on the table. What are the chances of taking advantage of that exit strategy that the Democrats are offering?
Well, as I say, I think at the end of the day, they probably will do it because, I'm sure they'll do it come January if they don't do it before the end of the year, but I think it's more likely than not they will do it before the end of the year, just because dragging it out further will make it ever that much more embarrassing when they ultimately have to turn around and agree to the president's terms. Just to be clear, I would say it is a hit to the economy, but people have to understand what's going on here. This is deficit reduction. This is the stuff that people like me said is a bad idea in a weak economy, and now I guess everyone agrees with me, which I'm happy for, but they're misrepresenting exactly what happens, because it's not that
we're paying higher taxes January 1st, that matters. What matters is as the year were to go on, so we get more deducted off our paychecks January 15th, January 31st, when we get paid in February, when we get paid in March. That will be a drag on the economy, as will the spending cuts. But none of that happens January 1st. So the idea that, oh, my God, if we don't do this by January 1st, this is close to loony. I mean, it's really is nuts. I mean, and all the economists will agree on that. I mean, you have some will say the financial markets are going to panic. And to all those people, I go, well, you know, when you become an expert in financial markets, show me your $1 billion. I mean, you know, this is just silliness. You know, people are trying to create this this pressure on President Obama to yield. And in this particular case, there is no real pressure. It's just, you know, the Washington elites who are trying to say, oh, you got to give the Republicans something. The reality is he doesn't have to give them a damn thing.
But is he likely to give them something? They're talking about altering or, in fact, I think the word reform has been the so-called entitlements, which I think in many ways is another piece of semantic framing that's detrimental, just like the fiscal cliff is hyperbole. The entitlements, they're talking about reforming, and that makes people that believe in Social Security and Medicare, which, have, you know, in the case of the former, Social Security are actually paid for. From what you're telling us, Dean Baker, I don't see why the president should be talking about making cuts in either Medicare or Social Security if indeed the situation is as you describe.
Well, you know, the question is whether he wants to have cuts in Social Security and Medicare, because he certainly doesn't have to have them. And, you know, from a policy standpoint, you know, just kind of logic here is you go, is that what caused the downturn? No one could say that with a straight face. Do we, you know, we look at our elderly, do we think they're doing too well? I mean, the median income for someone over age 65 is a hair less than $20,000 a year. We hear talk, you know, Pete Peterson, the Wall Street investment banker, has been making a crusade of going after Social Security and Medicare for three decades now. He always goes around the country saying, well, I don't need my Social Security and Medicare, which, you know, of course is true. But the reality is there are very few Pete Petersons. The number of people we could identify among the wealth, among the elderly as being wealthy are very few and far between. You know, we talk about tax increases on high-income people. Our cutoff that at least President Obama has been using is $250,000. If you use the same cutoff for the elderly in terms of kind of Social Security and Medicare, you could zero it out for all of them, and it wouldn't make any difference. There just aren't enough Pete Petersons. There aren't enough wealthy people. So from a policy standpoint, doesn't make sense to be cutting these programs. You're really hard-pressed to answer yes.
Well, Dean Baker, again, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. You mentioned Pete Peterson, who's been on this jihad. It's telling us the sky is falling because of the deficits. He also funded in part the Simpson-Bowles Commission that ex-President Bill Clinton talks about as though it were the tablets that Moses brought down from the mountain. Obama has also talked positively about Simpson-Bowles. I noticed that Pete Peterson and the Center for American Progress have joined forces on a big conference they're holding on the deficit. The Center for American Progress is supposed to be close to the White House. Why are they drinking the Kool-Aid, too?
Well, it's, you know, it's hard to say their specific motives. I mean, I will point out some of the people close to the Center for American Progress have important Wall Street ties. Most importantly, Robert Rubin, you know, was President Clinton's Treasury Secretary and then went on to work at Citigroup. And, of course, was right in the middle of things when everything blew up on Wall Street. He walked away with over $100 million from his tenure there, and, you know, we got stuck with the bill bailing out Citigroup. But, you know, that's, you know, you do have people associated with the Center for American Progress with those ties. Now, that's not everyone there. Many of them are more liberal, more progressive. But you do also have people, as I say, that very much share, I think, Pete Peterson's agenda in certain areas.
Well, I'm just making the point that he seems to be making inroads into the so-called progressive think tanks, and that's nervous-making to the extent that there'll be some sort of voluntary fiscal suicide going on here that's entirely unnecessary. I mean, you were saying earlier that most economists, Dean Baker, have realized that austerity is a bad idea, and the evidence ought to be manifest from what's happening in Europe. But that's the consequences for these deficit reductions. And if the tax cuts for the middle class and working Americans are allowed to expire, then that's a huge hit to the economy. So again, there's no reason to feel confident that in the long run, the economic establishment hasn't drunk the deficit Kool-Aid.
There's a long-run and short-run issue. The short-run issue, should tax cuts for middle-income people expire, I think there's widespread agreement that they should not. So in terms of, you know, are we going to see a big hit to the economy in 2013 from that, I think the answer is clearly no. They will work that out. But over, say, the next 2, 3, 4 years, might they push more austerity than we should be having? I think that's a very real risk, because we really do have it in people's heads that the big problem facing the country is the deficit, as opposed to the fact that we're still trying to recover from the collapse of the housing bubble. That sort of disappeared from discussion. It's sort of surreal the way we just disappeared the collapse of the housing bubble from economic discussions.
Well, the other thing that's not likely to change, at least to my mind, is that the Republican Party, which have got us into this situation that has led to this sequester and all of this so-called fiscal cliff nonsense, is the fact that they've been playing chicken with the American economy. And the Republicans would apparently prefer to play chicken and extort and have these Tea Party tantrums, and they are prepared to govern. So do you see any indication that the Republicans are going to start governing?
Well, I think a lot's going to depend on the immediate outcome of this battle, because we have an immediate issue with how we resolve this fiscal standoff around January 1st. And a lot, I think, will depend on how that ends up being resolved, because the bigger issue, or I should say the more potentially disastrous issue, would be the extension of the debt ceiling, which is going to come due somewhere around February 20th. And there you really do face a serious situation. I mean, I think people exaggerate that, but if the Treasury Secretary has to say, I can't pay the bills, that would be a serious situation. And, of course, the Republicans did threaten to put us in that situation back in the summer of 2011. If they end up being, in effect, embarrassed by, you know, pushing us to this sort of standoff again, then they might let the debt ceiling go through a sort of routine thing, as it's always been in the past. So, you know, the question is whether they think there's a political payoff to this sort of brinkmanship, this sort of game of chicken. I think they actually were not happy how they came out of the last battle on the debt ceiling. And if they lose again with this fiscal standoff, then they may try different tactics.
Well, there are mixed signals on that, Dean Baker. In the Senate, Harry Reid brought up a bill that allowed the president to unilaterally raise the debt ceiling, and he required 51 votes for it to pass, and Mitch McConnell said no, he wants 60 votes. So there you have the filibuster again, which they don't even have to enact. They just have to say it, that they're going to filibuster it, and it all goes away, which is pretty surreal. And on the House side, there's a different some indication in as much as Boehner removed some of these Tea Party zealots from key committees. So I guess it's no surprise in the Senate that McConnell is not playing ball. But does it indicate further that they want to keep this option open to force a showdown over the debt ceiling in mid-February?
Well, for now, at least, I think they definitely want to keep the option open. Again, I think a lot will depend how the current battle is resolved. And if it ends up with, you know, the Republicans looking foolish, which I think there's a fairly good chance it will, since they've hugely overplayed their hand, then I think they might be inclined. They may not formally surrender the power, but they may simply agree to let the debt ceiling go through without a big fight. Because, you know, again, my guess will be that come February, they aren't going to want to be in a situation where, again, looks like they're holding the economy hostage.
Well, there's further evidence of the hollow nature of the Republican argument about the 2% protecting, you know, the tax breaks for the millionaires and billionaires. There was a meeting in Washington of all the top defense executives, and surprisingly, most of them, without being prompted, talked about how they're perfectly happy to have their taxes raised. And also, if you look at Wall Street, there's no indication of any panic over this so-called fiscal cliff. In fact, you could make the case that President Obama is one of the best moderate Republican presidents that Wall Street's ever had. I mean, the rich have never had it so good in this country. Surely they've never paid lower taxes. They're sitting on vast profits. Corporate America's sitting on tons of money. What the hell are they complaining about?
Well, I think the idea is that however much they have, they always think they could have more. And, you know, so however much they're paying in taxes, their view is they should pay less. However much they have in profits, they should have more. I think that's their thinking. And, you know, the Republicans are saying, yeah, we know Obama gave you lots of money, but we'll give you even more money. And I think that's kind of where it's coming from. But the idea that somehow if they're back at Clinton-era tax rates, I mean, they're still way below the tax rates that we had in the 50s and 60s, which were a period of enormous prosperity. So the idea that, you know, if we got back to the tax rates we had just 10 or 12 years ago, that's going to bring the economy to a standstill and no one's going to invest. I mean, it's kind of laughable. But, you know, what the hell? They're going to say that if they think it'll get them lower taxes.
Well, but isn't there something going on in terms of our oligarchy and the way they think? Because they're not all in lockstep here. My understanding is that this Grover Norquist fellow that's often referred to as Liberace with a wife, yet this strange character who has these peculiar little meetings that he has with all of his acolytes, and they intimidate the Congress into signing pledges not to raise taxes. He's entirely funded by a group of very right-wing billionaires like the Koch brothers. And I don't know why the press don't focus on who funds this guy rather than ascribe these mythical powers to this weird fellow. That's what's going on the one hand. And then, as I mentioned, you've got all these defense executives saying, no, we should pay more taxes.
Well, look, the media's done a horrible job on reporting on a whole set of issues. And, you know, and again, getting back to the whole issue about the debt crisis, we have this group, the Campaign to Fix the Debt, that Pete Peterson got started and is funded by other corporate executives. And they're treated with immense respect here. It's just as though they're independent experts coming in to intervene for the economy's good, as opposed to people who have an enormous amount at stake. I mean, it's kind of laughable, and it's considered incredibly rude when I point out to people that, you know, these are actually just a bunch of rich corporate executives who are trying to buy their way when they could not possibly get their agenda through the election. I mean, we did just have an election campaign. So, you know, if you thought it was a really good idea to cut Social Security, Medicare, because you're worried about the long-term debt, why didn't you go out and back candidates who were saying that? Well, of course, candidates who said that, you know, got their butts kicked last month. So you know, that should be pointed out in the media. But, you know, the reality is that a lot of people in the media have that same agenda, so they're happy to cover up for them.
Well, just in closing, Dean Baker, in terms of the nation's economic literacy, is there any indications that people are beginning to understand the economic nonsense being proffered by the deficit hawks vis-a-vis the reality that what really has put the economy in the toilet is what happened on Wall Street? And Wall Street is back stronger than ever, and the financialization of our economy continues. Is anybody starting to recognize that the problems on Wall Street are not in terms of Americans, middle class and working Americans living too high on the hog?
Well, I think people are enormously confused about the nature of the economy's problems, how we got here. There's been an enormous amount of confusion, much of it deliberately generated. The one real plus sign, I'll say, though, is that people think they have a right to their Social Security and Medicare, and they're very angry if people want to take it away from them. And that's really across the political spectrum. You see very little difference in the support for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, Republican, Democrats, people think of themselves as conservatives, even people identify with the Tea Party. The support is overwhelming, and it's across the board. And that's going to make it difficult for these guys to get their way. And, you know, they know the political realities, and that's why they have to try and do it all through these backroom deals.
Yeah, but the people are right to feel that they need to protect Social Security and Medicare because they paid for them.
Of course they're right. I'm not saying they're wrong at all. They absolutely should be defending them. And look, we're a rich country. We aren't poorer today than we were 20 or 30 years ago. We're a lot richer. So the idea that people should should be living more poorly today than they did in, you know, 1990 or 1980. That's crazy. We have the wealth. The problem is that it's all gone to those at the top. And insofar as we're concerned, we don't have the money. Well, we should get it from the people who have it, you know. And basically, they've rigged the rules so all the money goes to them. And we have to work on unrigging those rules. But, you know, basic understanding, people's exactly right. They paid for these benefits. They have them coming to them. And they should be very angry if politicians want to take it away from them.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the dark genius, the head of Fox News, Roger Ailes.
Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in from every crevice, every crack. Anybody want to tell it like it is to each other? Like you would to a sister or a brother.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Kerwin Swint, an author, speaker, and professor of politics at Kennesaw State University in Atlanta, specializing in campaigns, elections, and mass media. He's the author of Dark Genius, the influential career of legendary political operative and Fox News founder Roger Ailes. And his latest book is The King Whisperers, Power Behind the Throne, From Rasputin to Rove. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Kerwin Swint.
Hello, Ian. Glad to be with you.
And your latest book, of course, King Whisperers, The Power Behind the Throne, From Rasputin to Rove. The theme of that book, I think, was very graphically illustrated by the tape that Bob Woodward of the Washington Post released of a conversation between an emissary of Roger Ailes, head of Fox News, trying to solicit General Petraeus to become president of the United States, in which Roger Ailes apparently offered up his expertise to run the campaign, and his boss, Rupert Murdoch, would bankroll Petraeus for president, running against President Obama for re-election. So that, to me, I think is the epitome of the King Whisperers, the power behind the throne.
Well, you're exactly right, and that's exactly why Roger Ailes and Karl Rove are both major characters in my last book, The King Whisperers. It portrays people through history pulling strings behind the throne, as it were. And a lot of the American political consultants are in that book. There's a chapter that features people like Ailes as consultants and trying to be power brokers out of sight. But, of course, Roger Ailes is a prime figure in both American politics and media, so it's hard for him to stay out of sight the way that some others through history have been.
Well, in this tape that Bob Woodward of the Washington Post got hold of somehow and released, what was interesting, it was all fascinating, really, but at the end there, K.T. McFarland, his emissary, Fox News contributor, former National Security Council, a member of, I think, in three Republican administrations, what was striking about her was that she seemed to be so ideological and so completely ignorant of national security affairs. Every time Petraeus would say something, which I found fascinating about his take on military and intelligence issues, she'd go on with, an ideological rant against Democrats. However, at the end there, she talks about how Roger is very paranoid. And I understand that Ailes has more security than most heads of state. He travels in armored limousines and has phalanxes of bodyguards. What is the source of his paranoia?
Well, I think he's always been very defensive. He has a little bit of a Nixonian sort of sense of everyone is against me and I'm battling against all of these forces that are on the political left, and he has to take up the banner of the political right. And I think Roger Ailes is one of these figures that has grown so used to being a power broker. I think McFarlane believed that Petraeus might drop everything if he knew that Roger Ailes was going to run his campaign and help fund his campaign. So there seems to be this expectation that if only Roger is involved and has the power of the News Corp behind him, Petraeus would fall into line and be someone that they could push to the presidency.
So I'm just trying to get a handle on the mindset here, Dr. Kerwin Swint. Again, author of Dark Genius, The Influential Career of Legendary Political Operative and Fox News Founder Roger Ailes, and his latest book continues the investigation into power broker behind the scenes, The King Whisperer's Power Behind the Throne, From Rasputin to Rove. This woman, Katie McFarland, in this tape goes on about the Obama agenda, where he's going to push through health care, and then he's going to capture the economy and socialize it, and then finally take over education and indoctrinate our children ad infinitum into a kind of socialist stupor. It's so fantastical that you just have to laugh because, you know, I think most people who objective observers recognize the United States is a fairly right-wing country. And in the idea of it being socialist is about as absurd as Sharia law coming into play here. So what is McFarlane and Roger Ailes in that same mindset that they have to invent this bogeyman in order to justify their own power?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, a book like Dark Genius, which I wrote about Roger Ailes' career, you get the sense that Fox News is an ideological setup, you know, from top to bottom. And in fact, it's the first completely ideological news network that we've had. And that's why everything they do at Fox News is sort of designed to expose the left. And so they spend a lot of time for the last 4 years, and I assume for the next 4 years, in trying to expose the Obama administration as being sort of closet socialists. And this sort of fits right in with that mentality. And a lot of the news operation at Fox News is set up to sort of cater to the right wing and portray the left as conspiratorial and being involved in some gigantic socialist plot to take over the country. And I think a lot of them really believe that, and certainly some of the news reporting and news management is designed to sort of have that sort of mentality, that mindset, that this is all a big expose of the left.
So in this tape, Katie McFarland offered up, she was his Roger Ailes' emissary, and she offered up Roger Ailes' services to, he would take leave of absence from running Fox News and run Petraeus' presidential campaign, which is pretty extraordinary in itself. But he also...
That's amazing, yeah.
She also offered that the whole project would be bankrolled by Rupert Murdoch. So it was almost like all Petraeus had to do was sign on the dotted line. It was a done deal. How much does Ailes speak for Murdoch?
Well, Murdoch has placed incredible faith in Roger Ailes. He is very aware of the man's talents in the communication realm and his political savvy when it comes to managing politics behind the scenes and out front, pulling the strings. And Rupert Murdoch is someone that has always gotten very involved in politics. He always cozies up to whether it's a Tony Blair or a David Cameron or a Hillary Clinton or now a Barack Obama. And tried to get on their good side, but, you know, is someone very keen on trying to stay abreast of the political wave that's coming around. And so I think that Rupert Murdoch has tremendous confidence in Roger Ailes' ability to do those things. Whether that always pays off or whether they have their judgment right, that's another question. But I think they believe that they can manage things and sort of push the envelope the way they want it to go.
But Dr. Kerwin Swint, at what point is there going to be a reckoning? You would have thought that what was revealed in the hearings in Great Britain about the abuses of not Fox News in this case, News International, mm-hmm. Murdoch's company over there in terms of corrupting the British police, hacking into citizens' phones, manipulating the family of a young girl that was kidnapped and murdered. That's about as low as you could go. And then on top of that, now here in the United States, we have evidence of the way they try to be kingmakers and essentially run our politics and choose our leaders. At some point, you would think that there would be some outrage in this country about the idea that this transplant from Australia, who is not just dominate or trying to set the political agenda, but he's also trying to literally pick our president.
Well, it's amazing what egos can do, and the might makes right sort of mindset, I think, is prevalent at News Corp. Roger Ailes, is a master at manipulating news and information, and in the case of Fox News, they have a huge television market. They're a very loyal viewership that maybe they believe that insulates them from sort of having to pay any costs. But if there's any indication of laws being broken or rules being violated, they're going to have to pay. And, if that comes to light, then that large viewership's not going to protect them. And we'll have to see what comes of that. It's very interesting, though, that they believe that they can continue to manage things, to push things, and to buy their way out of trouble when it comes.
Well, they're trying to dismiss this tape as a joke, which, of course, is pathetic, because it's so clear that this is a serious offer, and it's pretty clear that General Petraeus thinks it's a serious offer, and he doesn't want to offend them in any way. He doesn't want the job because he's about to take the CIA job, which he, by the way, talks about, and she completely misunderstands what he's talking about, why he wants to be head of CIA. And, of course, ironically, he talks about how much he loves his wife as well. Mm. So you'd think that, apart from Woodward, I don't see a lot of the press jumping on this and saying, wait a minute, you can't call yourselves a journalistic operation if you're trying to, not only are you the propaganda arm of the Republican Party, now you are the Republican Party. That's your brand, not Fox, but, or at least be honest about it.
Well, people for years have been talking about Fox News as being politically oriented. And really, it seems like everyone's in on the joke. The people at Fox News, people at other news organizations, it seems like they know the fix is in, and they know what's going on there. But publicly, Fox News continues to sort of put up this front of being an objective news organization, when, of course, everyone knows they're not. It's just continues the sort of the facade of trying to bring fair and objective news when it's really a political format.
So in other words, this pravda of the Republican Party, the fact that everybody kind of recognizes the reality, it's reached the point where people have accepted it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a sort of read my lips or do what I say, not what I do, kind of thing. But like I said, that loyal viewership eats it up, and the ratings are there to sort of provide the operating revenue to keep it going, and legitimize the operation as a news organization.
But that leads you to the scary conclusion that there are millions of Americans who think they're actually getting the news from Fox.
Well, it's a news product that a lot of Americans like. They're comfortable with it. They believe that it sort of hits them where they live, that sort of thing. It's sort of like the audience for news radio, talk radio, AM talk radio. There's a certain segment that gravitates towards that because it's what they believe, and it's the version of the news that they find comfortable.
Right. Well, of course, that's a national trend, regrettably, Dr. Cohen-Swint, that people do reality shopping. Liberals go to MSNBC to reinforce their already cherished beliefs, and conservatives go to Fox, and Christians go to Christian
exactly.
broadcasting. So that's a broader national problem we have, where there's no consensus anymore on what's true. And that's another discussion we could have at another time, Dr. Cohen-Swint.
Right.
But in terms of the actual, what's your new book? Your new book, King Whisperers, Power Behind the Throne, from Rasputin to Rove, talks about these characters like Karl Rove and Roger Ailes. But the previous book, Dark Genius, The Influential Career of Legendary Political Operative and Fox News Founder Roger Ailes, really explains the man's talent. I mean, if you look at Fox News, it's really well done. You have to admit it. I mean, the content is bizarre, but the presentations are great. I mean, they're a very slick operation. He knows how to produce television.
He does. He's a master programmer. And of course, he got his start with daytime television, a program called The Mike Douglas Show. And he learned how to, the art of production. He learned about framing and lighting and staging, stagecraft. And he brought a lot of those talents to politics for years when he worked for Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan and many other Republicans and became this sort of master communicator. And his skill really is in stagecraft and teaching newsreaders and politicians how to communicate and how to be orators, that sort of communication approach. And he's very good at it and produces very good television shows, which is his power. And he's become a very valuable financial commodity for Rupert Murdoch in terms of Fox News being a revenue generator. It's amazing what he's been able to do.
Well, so did he really learn from Nixon's famous debate against JFK, the famous Kennedy-Nixon debate, which clearly Nixon lost because he had a 5 o'clock shadow and looked kind of somewhat furtive, whereas the other guy looked telegenic and handsome, etc. It sounds like maybe that was a learning experience for Ailes, which he spent his career fixing.
Exactly. I think it was. It's one of those lessons that developed their philosophy about how things should look and how things should be lit on stage and what colors people should wear. And TV being a visual medium, those things are important and they do send a sort of message. And he's one of the masters of being able to skillfully produce that kind of thing, both in politics and in TV broadcasting.
Well, there's no question that telegenic candidates get elected, and that's the new reality. The great political operative of Bill Clinton's, James Carville, once said that politics is show business for ugly people. and you get the impression here that if you've got that talent inherently, like Ronald Reagan had as a trained actor, or Bill Clinton had naturally, and Barack Obama has naturally, you've got an enormous advantage there. Do you think that because of Roger Ailes and these marketers of politicians that are out there, that we're going to end up with the Republican actor versus the Democratic actor?
Well, those kinds of communication skills definitely help. And one thing Roger Ailes has been able to do is bring that out in people. I mean, George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, was someone that didn't have those kinds of skills, but Ailes worked with him, and he got a lot better when Ailes was working with him. So one of the things he's been able to do is help people develop those skills and have them get better at communicating, which in politics does mean a lot.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Cohen-Swint, I asked earlier about why not more outrage about what's this tape and the idea that these power brokers behind the scenes are trying to choose our presidents for us, and one's expecting a little more pushback and a little more outrage here. But do you think that in the long run there is going to be any reckoning for Murdoch and for Ailes? One of the things I found extraordinary is that given what Ailes and Murdoch did to Obama in this last election cycle, where they did it, threw everything at him in the hope that they could defeat him, his FCC, Obama administration's FCC, are about to reward Murdoch and Fox by removing the cross-ownership rules, which will enable Murdoch to buy the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune. So I don't get it.
Well, nothing breeds success like more success. And the longer they're able to have high viewership, high revenue generating They're going to be able to accomplish a lot of what they want to do. The only kind of reckoning that would matter, I think, is declining viewership, declining ratings at places like Fox News. That's the only thing that would put a chink in their armor, put a dent in their armor.
Well, Dr. Cohen-Swinn, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Cohen-Swinn, who's an author, speaker, and professor of politics at Kennesaw State University in Atlanta, where he specializes in campaigns, elections, and mass media. He's the author of Dark Genius, the influential career of legendary political operative and Fox News founder Roger Ailes. And his latest book is The King Whisperers, Power Behind the Throne, From Rasputin to Rove. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll get an update on Egypt with the former head of the Political Science Department at American University of Cairo.
Bruce Rodner!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck!
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul!
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J!
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu!
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin!
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich!
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith!
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Sheila Carapico, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, where she researches the political economy of development with special emphasis on Arab countries. Until recently, she was the head of the political science department at the American University of Cairo, and her most recent book is Political Aid, Democracy Promotion, and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sheila Carapico.
Nice to be with you.
And clearly, you, of course, spent a lot of time in Cairo as head of the political science department at American University in Cairo, Sheila. And just in the last few days, in fact, five people have been killed, 644 injured just in the last day. President Mohamed Morsi is calling for dialogue, but his palace, the presidential palace, is surrounded by troops and tanks. And he's standing by his controversial decree, expanding his powers. So that's a sort of mixed message, isn't it?
Yes, it assuredly is. I think, things are so fluid, and clearly tempers are very high. He seems to have overplayed his hand, and to imagine that as, you know, Egypt's first elected president, then he can just, you know, make what seemed to a lot of people to be some pretty arbitrary decrees about matters as fundamental as the Constitution. And so I think he is genuinely a bit taken aback. And yet, of course, so are the people who are protesting against his decree, because, you know, their understanding is that this was to be a process which replaced the old dictator with a new government that would be somehow bound by rules rather than personal whim. So we have, again, a quite volatile situation at the moment.
And Sheila Carapica, do you think that Morsi's, the fact that he issued these arbitrary decrees and it's feeling his oats, if you will, in terms of power, is that motivated by the fact that he's a religious fundamentalist, that he sees things so black and white that he doesn't recognize that you can't impose the kind of religious and strictures on the secular Egyptians who actually brought about this revolution?
I think that perhaps a bit of it has to do with his fundamentalist leanings. But I also think, I was talking to an Egyptian today, who was saying, you know, that they're still operating in Egypt, and Morsi in particular, with a kind of very absolute notion of the powers of the executive, And so, I mean, I think some of the problems in the constitutional proposals stem from the religious element, and some of Morsi's do as well. But a lot of them have to do with the excessive concentration of power in the hands of the executive. And I actually think that's probably his real problem at the moment. You know, his real, if I might say, obtuseness has to do with, everybody in Egypt has grown up in a system where, you know, whatever the president says is what goes, and there are no, serious alternative channels except possibly the judiciary. And again, this is an area where he, you know, overplayed his hand by trying to sideline the judiciary, and that, I think, really does speak to the executive authority more than it does to religious belief.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sheila Carapico, who's professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. Recently, she was the head of the political science department at the American University of Cairo, and her most recent book is Political Aid, Democracy Promotion, and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. So given that he's often referred to now by the Egyptian opposition, again, the people who brought about this revolution against Mubarak, as the new pharaoh, I understand his other nickname is the spare tire because he was considered the second choice of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right. I mean, he's kind of an accidental president in a way. I mean, he's, you know, not, I don't think, terribly well qualified.
And that so, he's what's surprising about him though is that he's taken to power with alacrity, has he not?
He most certainly has. Yes, that's I think an accurate statement.
So my understanding, Sheila Carapico, is that what's happening here is the kind of tragedy of the opposition is one the French style. Election process that you had runoffs and then the top two ran. And so all of the representatives of the revolutionaries, the secular and the young, etc., lost out in the first round. So they had a terrible Hobson's choice between a relic of the Mubarak regime versus a religious fundamentalist. And that part of the problem with the opposition, the people that are in the streets now battling with the Muslim Brotherhood followers, is that they're kind of like the Occupy movement here in the United States. They are very pure. They just believe in getting rid of bad government, but not participating in the political process.
Well, you and I'm sure plenty of your listeners also know that in addition, as you say, to the kind of strange French system with the runoffs and so forth, but I mean, for all these many years when you had the ruling National Party, and then the only other party at all, of course, was the Brotherhood. And in the immediate aftermath of Mubarak's resignation, you know, there were a large number of groups that, you know, began kind of, frankly, forming parties willy-nilly. I mean, some of those, I think, will turn into viable parties, but in the short run, what they discovered was that they had you know, kind of a plethora of candidates and parties representing people who had opposed the whole administration, and then they stood against a reasonably unified Brotherhood, and frankly also, you know, what remains a still reasonably unified military and, you know, diehard Mubarak supporters. And so even if, which I'm not sure is the case, but even if, shall we say, that the protesters, the pro-democracy group, the youth, whatever you want to call them, the liberals, even if they were the majority, they're not the majority in the sense of constituting a sort of solid voting bloc. And one of the things that may be happening now is that they may be coming together in a much more concerted effort to form some kind of unified coalition.
But the problem surely is that if you don't weigh in now before this constitution is written, you're going to get stuck with the constitution that's going to shape the future. It's kind of like the argument over the Supreme Court. You know, a lot of people don't get too excited about voting for Democratic candidates, but the final argument is, well, you know, look what will happen. If you don't vote for this guy, you'll end up with more right-wingers on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and there's a real, I mean, there is, even in spite of what I just said, there is now, I think, a split among, shall we say, the opposition over those who seem to intend to boycott the constitutional referendum and those who intend to vote no. And actually, that was what happened in the first constitutional proposals that were, again, if you recall, rather oddly put together and then changed after the fact and so forth. And this looks like a replay of that. But there is a real risk that, you know, the referendum will be held, what, next week on the 15th, and that it will pass. And
it'll pass because too many people will abdicate and vote.
Right. Whereas the Brotherhood will, you know, turn its numbers out in significant force, and the majority of those who vote, you know, will vote yes, presumably. And so, I mean, there's clearly an effort now to prevent the vote from taking place. And some of that is coming from, for example, there's this large group of diplomats who said that they're not going to facilitate overseas voting. Which is a principled stand, but again might have the ironic effect of diluting the no vote, because probably a significant proportion of people living overseas would vote no. But I think, you know, now there's a lot of people just trying to stop the vote from going through, and I don't know if that's going to succeed or not.
So this really has echoes of the problem on the political left. A lot of leftists would rather be righteous than effective. And by abdicating and by turning your back on the political process, you end up with the worst possible outcome.
That could be. I mean, that could be. And, you know, right now I think, I mean, this is a slightly different point, but, you know, it's not just the left and the right. I mean, I really think there are three major groups now vying for power in Egypt. And, you know, obviously there's Morsi and the Brotherhood, and then there's this, you know, conglomerate of shall we say, left and liberal forces. And then, again, there's considerable power still in the old Mubarak appointees in the armed forces, and to a considerable extent in the judiciary, and also in the bureaucracy. And so it's really, in a way, it's a three-way struggle rather than a left-right struggle, pure and simple.
So tell us about the role of the Christians, the Coptic Christians. My understanding is that the richest guy in Egypt, who's a crony of Mubarak's, owns one of the private TV networks, and he's the guy that put out that videotape that came out of nowhere, produced here in Southern California by some Coptic Christian fanatic, I think is the only way to describe him.
Mm-hmm.
This horrible, cheesy movie that nobody ever saw, but it had terrible political consequences, resulting in the death of four Americans, two diplomats in Benghazi. What's going on with that constituency?
Well, the Coptic constituency is, you know, it's also a complex constituency. I mean, the church itself is really very conservative and in many ways was aligned with the Mubarak administration, the old pope who's only recently deceased. And there is a segment of the wealthiest and most powerful class in Egypt who are Copts. And there's certainly a segment of the Coptic population who are not only educated but Western educated. So they speak French at home or they speak English at home. They have advanced degrees. And then there are other Copts who are, you know, dirt poor. I mean, there's a community of Copts who live literally in the garbage heap, which is a huge garbage heap, by the way. And so it's often difficult to generalize about the Coptic constituency because, again, and even this is a slight simplification, on the one hand, it's correct to say that, you know, there's these garbage dwellers who are incredibly underprivileged and discriminated against. But on the other hand, there's some very wealthy and powerful people. And, you know, some of them, you know, they can hate monger with the best of them. And this Egyptian-American who made that film is a good example of somebody who, you know, was deliberately sowing hatred and sectarian conflict.
So what's the situation then vis-a-vis foreign interference in Egypt? Because the Saudis poured money in the parliamentary elections, and the Salafists came out of nowhere thanks to Saudi money. And they clearly have a reactionary agenda, which they've been doing for decades around the world, with very, very detrimental effects to my mind. But on the other hand, the Brotherhood, I don't believe, are that close to the Saudis, and they, of course, have a lot of influence over Hamas and, indeed, in the people that are fighting for the Free Syrian Army. So what are the lines of foreign sponsorship there?
Well, I mean, I think you identified the main one, which is the Saudis. And again, I mean, I'm never sure if it's the Saudis in the sense of the kingdom itself or, you know, individual princes who or you know, wealthy individuals who, you know, spend their money on overseas politics because there is no domestic politics. But regardless of which Saudis we're talking about, they clearly have been spending money, as you indicate, for decades on, you know, the most reactionary forms of Islamic education, and you know, that they did fund the Salafis, who, as you also suggested, you know, just turned out to be more of them than anyone ever thought in Egypt. And you know, the role of Saudi money in Arab politics in general is one of the kind of sinister and, you know, largely hidden from view factors. I agree with you that they're probably not, you know, a major source of support for Morsi and the Brotherhood, although, again, if you, you know, accept my suspicion that it's not one Saudi financing agency, but rather various ones, then surely some of their money must be going also to the Brotherhood.
Well,
so it's a complicated situation.
Well, of course, and it's one that the United States government appears to have been blind to forever. If they just look at what's happened in the Middle East, the fingerprints of Saudi mendacity are all over all the problems we have today. I thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Sheila Karapinka.
Nice to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapinka, Professor of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Richmond. Until recently, she was the head of the Political Science Department at the American University of Cairo, and her most recent book is Political Aid, Democracy Promotion, and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and I'll answer your questions. The conversation continues at facebook.com/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.